At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Down to business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
We're live at the Three Store here in Grafton Street. So, yes, we're never in studio anymore. We're always out and about. And I'm delighted to be back on Grafton Street. It's a street I know well. I worked on it for many years. And we're going to be soaking up the atmosphere of Grafton Street this morning. And to kick things off, we're going to have a review of the business and indeed some other stories with Linda Daly. She's a business reporter with the Sunday Times, and also by Conor Faulkner, who's a transport commentator and an old friend of the show. You're both very welcome to Grafton Street.
Thank you, Bobby.
Conor, you're a city centre man. You worked here over on St. William Street for as long as I know you.
Yeah, since God was a lad. I did 30 years in the AA, which was always a Dublin city centre business, and I'm involved since, as you know, Bobby, with the RIAC around on Dawson Street. So this is very much my stamping ground.
You're very welcome. And Linda, Sunday Times, I don't know, do you know much about Grafton Street? Is it a place you spent a lot of time in your youth?
Yes, it is. I once queued overnight for Oasis tickets, would you believe? So, yes, definitely.
There you go. You heard it all here, folks. Well, let's start with some of the big stories that are out and about this morning. Conor, maybe we'll start with you. Fears consumers will be affected as the regulator disbands the protection unit, and this is the central bank's move that has been greeted with some shock, that looks to be putting the consumer maybe to the rear of things in their operations.
It's a bit bewildering, isn't it? I mean, the consumer protection is a central bank function. There was a standalone entity back in the day, but it's been a central bank function for many years. And we did have the Consumer Protection Commissioner, Colin Kincaid, which was an executive, senior executive role in the central bank. Charlie Weston reporting this morning in the Indo, and I think it's in other coverage as well, that he's not being replaced when he steps down, and his function is essentially being dissipated amongst the other. Now, there's 160 odd staff that will still be doing consumer protection work. But for me, it feels a little bit counterintuitive. I said, you know, some consumer advocates are saying they're baffled. If you don't have a seat, Bobby, at the exec in the C-suite, you know, then you're unlikely. Yeah.
And this is a department that has taken its flak, as Charlie tells us, the role in the central bank in the banking collapse from 28, the tracker mortgage scandal, the sale of mortgages to vulture funds, the collapse of Custom House Capital, among many other litanies of not great performance.
Yeah, well, lots of bad stuff has happened, but I mean, that's not an argument for not strengthening the function or giving that function the executive voice, if you like. We've plenty of criticisms over the years. I mean, I remember we were selling insurance and I used to pull my hair out that, you know, they cared more about fitting all the terms and conditions into the audio of a radio ad than they did about the sort of the basic governance and fiscal rectitude of the companies themselves. But we do need a strong consumer voice, and it's very hard to see how this helps.
Sure. Linda, I'm reading some of the PR speak coming from the article. In the new structure, our focus on the protection of consumers will be strengthened by integrating and embedding it explicitly in the supervisory responsibilities of the directors in the financial regulation area of the central bank. What waffle? Waffle is that?
I mean, look, I suppose if you were to be a devil's advocate, you could say, look, 169 people dotted throughout the organisation, if they have, you know, something to say in various meetings, they maybe get their voice ahead. But like as Conor said, yeah, it's better to have somebody at the top of the chain rather than maybe dotted throughout. So Brendan Burgess makes a very good point in the article. He suggests consumer financial protection agencies should be set up. And in recent weeks, I've done a lot of work around Blackbee Investments, a Cork investment firm, and it's gone into liquidation. And a lot of the investors are just, there's no information on what's happening with their money. And there's a lot of worried people. So maybe an agency like that could kind of provide some.
And Brendan Burgess, as you mentioned, he's the consumer advocate and founder of AskAboutMoney.com. he says it seems weird and he's kind of bewildered by the whole strategy.
Yeah, I don't see the sense in it, really. I don't, and it's very hard to see how it strengthens the consumer protection role. And I presume, you know, there is a general acceptance that we do need that role fulfilled. So I'm a little baffled by it, to be honest with you.
Well, let's baffle you some more, Connor, because Cliff Taylor is writing about the power of the over 65s. They're better off, and they call all the political shots. An interesting article.
Yeah.
Just setting out the stable.
Yeah, that's right.
Those 65 pluses society.
Yeah, from the Irish Times and quoting ESRI data. And look, there's a couple of things that have happened with that over 65, that baby boomer demographic. They profile very differently from over 65s 20 years ago. For example, there's way more of them at work. I mean, if you wind the clock back 10 years, there were about 50,000 of the over 65s who were actively in the workforce. It's now nearly 120,000.
Yeah.
And given the nature, often they're in quite senior roles, so they'll sort of pull up salary averages. But for me, the real thing, the revelation is that the over 65s now have more disposable income than under 65s, and that was not previously the case. The big difference, I think, for that demographic is housing.
Yeah.
Once that mortgage is paid off, you can whistle down Grafton Street in comparison to your younger peers, and that obviously frees
you're
up
so
a lot
right.
of cash.
Yeah. You're so right, Linda. Mortgage-free is the new wealthy.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, I'm a long way off 65, Bobby, but I would like to think that when I get to 65, I will be better off than I am now, and that's the year that my mortgage stops.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll have to work until I'm 70.
Well, I'm 64, and I tell you, with four daughters out there, I'm going broke rapidly.
I feel a Beatles song coming on, Bobby.
But he also, you know, some of the things that he says that, you know, that those with houses have a veto on how the next generation live.
Yeah.
Like, that's quite striking in that, you know, with our planning process as it is, Connor,
yeah.
that, you know, I've somebody who has paid down their mortgage is sitting pretty. They can object to anything that's been built around them.
And they can throw sand into the machinery and make sure that nothing happens or nothing happens quickly because they're protecting their wealth. We have this very strange paradigm in Ireland, and it's not universal. But for many, many people, the aspiration, because they see their house as their pension. So your property, your principal private residence is also your principal pool of savings.
Yeah.
So you're deeply sensitive about anything that might affect the price of it. And that doesn't have to be like that, but it's a generational, intergenerational thing here in Ireland. Not the case in continental Europe, for example. But maybe we, you know, fundamentally need to decouple ourselves from this obsession with home ownership. And needless to say, I know one of the other stories we're going to be talking about, we need to house more people. We have a growing country, growing population.
Yeah.
We need to build 50,000 new houses a year. And we are clearly not going the right way about doing it.
Well, let's move on to that, Linda. Cairn Homes, the subheading here is that the boss, excuse me, Stanley, has paid, Michael Stanley, has sold 40 million of shares as profit soar. But the underlying results here are of a very profitable company that's doing exceptionally well in a very different, very difficult marketplace.
Yeah, and I suppose really it kind of shines a light on how housing has and how companies like Cairn and Glenveagh have kind of ramped up their construction. Somebody once described it to me as a big wheel when we were kind of starting to get back into the swing of construction, and it was this giant wheel and it had to slowly ramp up. And I suppose really is I was at a meeting there during the week with the head of Glenveagh, and he said it's finally ramped up. So Cairn and Glenveagh are getting they're getting their profits. They're definitely seeing the profit, and definitely Michael Stanley benefited this week. But they are also building more homes.
Well, if we look at the turnover in this business, Cairn Homes been up 67% and 9,500 energy efficient houses built this year. Which is a quarter of all the new houses being built.
It's a hell of a amount.
This is a serious player in the house building market.
Yeah, and listen, delighted for them. It's great to see an Irish business doing well, and good luck to Michael Stanley. I think, you know, it's great to see. What I was encouraged by in the article is how bullish he is about next year. And maybe there is that flywheel effect, Linda, where, you know, we have now pointed our capacity towards building homes, and it is starting to happen. But he reckons that, interestingly, he's not finding a labour shortage, which was one of the things that was going to be one of the big inhibitors. He's just not seeing that. And he reckons that we could hit 60,000 completions next year, which will be an extraordinary rise in output and clearly badly needed. You crack on, lads, and good luck with the money.
I don't know when the last time you went looking for a plumber or an electrician is, but my experience certainly is that there isn't too many of them around.
Well, yes, maybe particular challenges of the Kerr estate and Manse might have been an issue there.
All right, well, we'll move on. Linda, Intel's research and development facility at Shannon is sadly to close next year. It does seem, though, that a lot of the people here are basically going to be redeployed, from what I can read.
Yeah, so the 750 people employed at the Shannon facility, and only 300 of those are based in the area. I say only 300. I'm sure the 300 people who are based there wouldn't be too pleased about it. But a lot are hybrid workers. A lot maybe based around from Leixlip. Yeah. And I suppose if you consider, like, Intel has invested $17 billion in its Leixlip campus. So it does make sense that perhaps it would bring all its employees together. And the packages are quite good.
There was some suggestion, Conor, that, you know, that this redeployment may not go back to Leixlip, that it could go to some other jurisdictions, but the jury seems to be out on that.
Yeah, and look, we have to be sanguine about that. It may be the case that some of those roles disappear into sort of the virtual ether. And as you know, we discussed, you can do your work from anywhere. They're not necessarily based there. But I think we just have to be a little bit relaxed about that and look for other jobs inbound, either in the Intel Corporation or elsewhere. So it's never good news. You know, you read a facility's been there for a long time and you read a headline figure, 300 jobs, 750 jobs. It feels like a bad story, but I'm not sure it really is. And I think if you stand back and look at Intel, what a wonderful 35-year relationship
As Linda says, you feel for any of the people affected by this, but it does appear in the short term that there's so much going on that, but long term, maybe we should be more worried about the prognosis for Intel. And it's been a huge contributor, both financially and otherwise, to the Irish economy.
Yeah, it has. And it felt over the years like that were a lot of eggs in that particular basket. I think we're a little bit more diverse now, Intel remains a giant player. But look, Intel's going to continue to prosper. And in the scale of their operation, this is a very sort of minor rejig for them. And I think net-net, there probably won't be a huge loss to Ireland Inc., although I appreciate if you're down in Shannon, it won't feel like that today.
Sure. Linda, I know we've a motoring expert on the show, but I'm going to ask you about this next story because Europe pulls back from EV shift as car buyers snub pricey models. There's a lot going on in this market, and I'm sure Conor will tell us more, but what was your own take on this?
Well, I mean, you know, I can see why the BYD model has become so popular. I mean, I get into every second taxi and they're driving a BYD car now.
And I think they get 5,000 or maybe it's 10,000, is it?
Off. Yeah. So it's a huge amount. And I suppose really it just goes to show, if you look at the cheapest model, the European model, it's a Fiat. It's 35,000. A lot of people can't afford that. The BYD, which I think is a bigger car, is only 33,000. So it's not surprising then that European EV makers are suffering. And then Volvo has decided that it's not going to make just purely electric cars before 2030.
Yeah, I suppose, Conor, the overriding thing in this article in the Irish Examiner by William Wilkes is all the manufacturers now coming out one after another saying, We're out or we're part out or we're focusing on hybrid. It seems to be bad news for the European market.
It is, and they're scaling back on their ambitions. Germany's the big driver of this, and Volkswagen has really suffered. Now, over the last number of years, Volkswagen a few years ago announced an enormous R&D effort into electric cars. It was sort of like a moonshot. They're talking about billions per annum that they were going to invest in it. Volvo had said that all of their cars would be battery EVs by 2030. They're pulling back on that now. But if you look across the globe, there's three main areas where it's happening, if you like. China is building electric cars. The United States is making very significant progress on that. Europe is not. Europe is being anemic about this. If you talk to an American entrepreneur, they'll say, oh, that's just typical Europeans. You know, they can't innovate, they can't do things quickly. And I think the power of European capital and the investment that's going in, I think European car manufacturers will catch up. And I do believe with certainty that the future is battery electric vehicles. They don't have good mass market models that are cheap yet. Also, and including here in Ireland, some of the European governments are paring back on the incentives. They're watching the car tax revenue disappear.
Yeah.
And they're pulling away here and there at the little perks that were encouraging. And it can be the little things, Bobby.
Yeah.
You don't get cheap tolls on the M50 anymore. Well, sod it, I won't buy an electric car then.
So are we at a crossroads here when we look at manufacturers stepping back? Surely we should be concerned.
Well, I think hokey cokey. The European manufacturers promised too much a few years ago. Volvo saying they'd phase out all combustion engines by 2030. They're behind that target. But nevertheless, I mean, EVs are growing in Europe and globally, and we will have to adjust to that. Long term, we know we can't stick with fossil fuel. So I think the European manufacturers will gradually improve, but as of right now, in a three-horse race, they're conspicuously third behind the Chinese and the Americans.
Okay, I want to talk about bikes and bike sheds, Linda. Nice piece by Senan Maloney in today's Independent. Basically, he's been watching this story for quite some time about the cost of the €336,000 bike shed that was built in Leinster House. Tell us more.
Yeah, so he's been going in and out of Leinster House, and he spoke to a worker there who explained to him that it wasn't supposed to be a shed. The reason it wasn't supposed to be a shed, and the reason it only has one side and three sides exposed, is because there were fears that people would put things like lawnmowers in said shed.
Making it a shed.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, there were practical reasons why it didn't have a door. But also points out that only 4.5 bicycles are put into it every day, and it has capacity for 18.
So about not even one-third of the capacity.
The thing that shocked me, Bobby, was not so much the scale of cock-up, which we can make jokes about, but really is shocking. But the thing that frustrated me was OPW's first response was to defend it.
Yeah.
To actually come out and say it was using lovely Irish granite. And to even say something like that, I think, lifts the bonnet on some really deep dysfunction there. Not the only one who's made the observation.
Well, Ken Fox, in today's Irish Times, looks back, and he quotes the former OPW manager I suppose he is a whistleblower, Alan Morgan, about some of the litanies of the past.
It's unbelievable.
It's quite disturbing to see how taxpayers' money has actually been spent.
Yeah, public sector itis. Responsibility for budgets is diffused. Things go wrong. There's no one person's fault. And fundamentally, and this isn't an insult to public servants, but fundamentally it's a very different mindset when it's not your money. It's very easy to waste other people's ones and zeros without feeling the pinch yourself. As you know well, Bobby, try that in the private sector and you wind up going broke.
Yeah.
And hence you avoid doing it. And no such motivations appear to constrain the behaviour of government departments. It's not a party political thing, it's not an OPW thing, but it is definitely a malaise that costs
absolutely
us a lot.
Well, I know we said we wouldn't joke about it, but there is a letter in today's Irish Times from Noel Shanahy in Faithlake in County Waterford, and I'm going to ask Linda to read out the letter, if she would.
This is an excellent letter. So, sir, I'm a bit of a slow learner, but the penny is finally beginning to drop. 54 million for electric voting machines, that's dynamic polling. 2.24 billion for a new children's hospital, that's dynamic tendering. €500 for a concert ticket, that's dynamic pricing. 336,000 for a bike shed, that's dynamic subcontracting.
There you go. You heard it here, folks. What a great letter. And it's good that we can see the lighter side of these things. I want to thank my guests, Conor Falkland and Linda Daly. Thanks for joining us here in Grafton Street this morning. Great to talk to you both.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit Hyland.com.